Application Academy is closing if you are applying to medical school in 2024 to start in 2025. We are closing in mid-April, April 12th or 13th, somewhere around there, somewhere in mid-April. We're closing our door. It's time for you to get in to Application Academy to get the support you need to put together your story so that you aren't one of those students that end up rejected because you didn't know how to tell your story. Come join us at applicationacademy.com. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. I'll see you soon at applicationacademy.com. The pre-med path can be super confusing. If you'd love some help on your path or on your applications, use the promo code PMY for pre-med years, PMY, over at medicalschoolhq.net and get some help from some of our experts, former directors of admissions, admissions officers, other experts. We have a small team ready to help you today. Again, that's promo code PMY to get a discount on our services at medicalschoolhq.net. If you're applying to medical school in 2022 to start medical school in 2023, join me Wednesday or Thursday, Wednesday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern or Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern at premedworkshop.com. Go register today. I'm going to show you how to tell your story in your application. Again, that's premedworkshop.com. If you are applying to medical school in 2022, be there or be square. The Medical School HQ Podcast, session number 44. Welcome back to the Medical School HQ Podcast, the place to learn how to excel as a pre-med student, learn what it takes to survive medical school, and turn your dreams of becoming a physician into reality. We're bringing you the most unbiased, honest, and accurate information available online. My name is Ryan Gray, and I'll be your host today. So today I have a long conversation and probably a boring conversation for a lot of you, but it's such an important topic to understand what it's like on the other side of medical school as you're paying back several hundred thousand dollars worth of student loans. So today I brought back Tony Sozo, who was with us also in episode 21. And Tony and I are going to talk about all the different options for loan repayments and what that might mean to your bottom line, what that leaves in your bank account at the end of the day. And we'll go over the pros and cons of everything and a lot of different options and things to think about. The ultimate advice that Tony gives is no matter what you do, allow yourself to have as many options possible at the end of the day. Meaning, if you take out private loans, you're limiting your options. If you have credit card debt, you're limiting your options. Those are just a couple of the examples that we talk about. Like I said, for some of you, it might be a little bit of a dry topic. So if you have a long drive, maybe it's not one you want to listen to right now. It might be one to listen to while you're home and are able to take some notes, because there's a lot of stuff that we talk about. One of the big things I want to talk about as I am recording this, And the day that this is released, this is going to go out September 25th, 2013. As of Monday, September 23rd, the Academy has opened. We have finally opened the Academy for a limited time. We're going to close it on September 26th at 3 p.m. Eastern. And we're doing that because we just want to let in a small group of people, and we already have about 20 or so, and we're reaching where we wanted the number of people for our small beta group. But we want to bring this group in, and we want to work with them closely and really find out what exactly you guys want and exactly what you guys need inside of the academy. And we're going to set up our first office hours here for next week and start getting content out there to help the students on their path to becoming physicians. If you haven't seen the academy, if you haven't checked it out yet, please go to medicalschoolhq.net/academy. If you go there before September 26th at 3 p.m. Eastern, you'll still have time to sign up. If you don't, then you might see an email sign-up sheet to get notified when we reopen. This is an awesome opportunity. It costs less than 2 coffees a month. I think you guys can afford that for this beta launch. It will go up a little bit after that. So one other thing I do want to mention besides the Awesome Academy are the awesome listeners that are still leaving 5-star ratings and 5-star reviews. This week we had a couple new ratings and we had one review by Doc Sink. She says, "I'm finished with med school. This even helps me, even though I've gone through the process. Great podcast." And Doc Sink is actually one of our former guests on the podcast, an anesthesiologist, who talked about how she corrected course after struggling through medical school. And she's actually one of the experts that we brought into the academy to talk about her path and to help others on theirs. So thank you to Doc Sink for that awesome review. Let's jump into the conversation with Tony. We talk about some of the basics, the basic math with the average debt that students have and what residents make. And so we'll jump into that now.
It's probably going to be, we get the average debt information and other information from the Association of American Medical Colleges, the AAMC, around October. So I'm estimating about $170,000 will be the average debt for all medical schools. Private schools will probably be approaching about $185,000 to $190,000, and that's a growing number, of course. The average residency salary, and that's an important thing to know, is about $50,000, depending on what parts of the country. In your major urban centers, you're probably averaging about $55,000. Unfortunately, we're seeing a growing number of students with over 200,000, over 250,000 coming out of medical schools. That number is growing, and now there's even a category of over 300,000 that we use. It's kind of startling. I mean, especially if you're an applicant and you deal with a lot of applicants who want this profession, but they get scared away when they see those numbers. The good news is what we're doing tonight, Ryan. We're going to show and demonstrate and discuss that if this is your dream, this is what you want to do, the options that are available now that weren't available even when you were going to school, medical school, will at least make people think that there's a possibility and they can do something here. So
let me interject and ask the question that many people are asking, and it's all over the news right now, even with undergrad, is why is medical school cost increasing so much? Where is that money going towards? If maybe you don't know the answer, but why is it so expensive to go to medical school?
Well, the answer that I always give, because I have some knowledge, is that it is costly to run a medical school because of what you need to impart and have for the students that are going there. You need to have the proper equipment, the Harveys, the simulated patients. Remember those?
Yeah.
And all of the new kinds of equipment that come out that students have to learn about. Plus, you really have to pay for good instruction and good professors and people who are accomplished and have demonstrated that. And also, you know, med schools are really no different than some of the undergraduate schools there's a whole movement of wellness. You want to make sure your students that come into your family are well taken care of. So having a gym and updating the gym and having special kinds of programs and yoga and Pilates and the things that just balance your life out. It costs a little bit as well. But the good news is that the money is going back to the students. Supposedly 2/3 to maybe 70% of the money that comes in goes for the educational instruction. And that's not always explained well. But it's costly because you have to keep up.
It's not going towards your Lamborghini.
What is that?
I've seen you drive that Lamborghini
around.
Yeah,
sure. It's a 12-year-old Subaru. Thank you very much.
So, and that's good to know. I don't know if I've ever seen that number of actually the percentage of the tuition that I'm paying is directly affecting me. So that's good to know.
Yeah.
And see if you can answer this question. A lot of students that I talk to pick medical schools based on tuition. And I tell them that's a bad thing to do.
I agree.
There might be a difference of $10,000, $20,000. But if that's what you're picking a medical school on and not picking it based on location, maybe you can't stand winter, you're going to get seasonal affective disorder and be depressed during the winter, and you're only applying to schools that are in the middle of Canada
yeah, right.
Because they're cheaper. You're picking for the wrong reasons. Can you talk a little bit about medical schools overall, and does it really matter if I'm saving $10,000 of tuition right now?
Yeah, I definitely have an opinion about that. Because I do this, I read a lot about what's happening on the undergraduate level. And it's funny, there are students that will call me during the month of June, just before we start working with the first year or the incoming class, I should say. And they kind of say, well, can I get some scholarship money from you and how much? And we give out grants that are just for 1 year at a time based on a whole host of information. And I think it's actually the wrong thing to do, to tell a student or an applicant, you might get X. I don't know that because I haven't seen your data. And it's only for 1 year. We may never get it again because your economics could change. And you're giving up a choice of a medical school based on a promise. It just doesn't make any sense. No, I think we're at a time now, and maybe this has always been, but we want the instant impressions about everything. We go to Google, we search something, we get an instant answer. And I think students are just not – I use the term go deeper. They will look at an interest rate and say, oh, that must be bad. This one's lower. This must be better. But if you look at the details of things, you find out it's different. People aren't going deep. I use an expression, Brian. It's kind of funny. The large print giveth. So when you see an ad or you see anything – or if you visit a school just for 1 day, the large print giveth, but it's the small print on the bottom that taketh away. And I think if we can get them to go deeper, the most important thing they should be thinking about, where do those students match? Can I see the match list? And they have some – those are pretty good appointments and pretty good assignments. And I see you got into dermatology. That's very hard to do. How safe do you feel? How comfortable do you feel there? What is the philosophy and the culture at that school?
Yeah.
And so on and so forth. So $10,000 difference over the course of your lifetime, over 50 years, isn't going to make that much of a difference.
Yeah. And maybe I'll put in the show notes. Maybe we can work those numbers and show the students that if you're taking an extra $10,000 over those 4 years, that you're only paying back X number of dollars a month. It's really not that much of a difference.
Well, it comes down to, 30 cents a day or something crazy like that.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right.
We'll work those numbers and show that in the
sure.
show notes. So, and people can get the show notes at medicalschoolhq.net/44. Episode 44, Tony, can you believe it?
That is amazing. How long have you been doing this now?
44 weeks.
That is phenomenal.
Every week, 44 weeks. So.
I am very impressed. I'm happy to be a part of it, too.
And we're glad that you're here for the second time. So students, it might be a dry topic for a lot of students, but it's one of the most important topics. So
we'll try to keep it in right to the point where they can grasp it and maybe do something. And I'll give them some homework, so to speak, as well.
I like it. just what they need, more homework. All right. So we want to talk about loan repayment. So you just mentioned the average indebtedness that the student is coming out with is about $170,000 right now.
Mm-hmm.
And to myself and to many students listening, $170,000 seems like an insurmountable mountain. So let's talk about some of the ways that we can dwindle that down with these loan repayment programs.
Right, and the loan repayment programs are going to allow the very vast and varied type of human being that comes out of med school, typically around age 27 or so, the chance to do other things with your life, not only with your career, because there are so many options. Ryan, if I can say one thing to your listeners, it's always best to have as many options as possible. Options make it work. So let's go into some of that. What we now have essentially are six repayment plans. Your listeners are familiar with the first three. They're the kinds of repayment plans I call time-driven. What does that mean? Tell me how much debt you have. Tell me how long you're going to repay it back. And we'll figure out the monthly payment. So obviously, if you take $170,000 and you say, I want to pay it over 10 years, 120 months, you're going to take all that money and squeeze it into 10 years. You're going to have a relatively high monthly payment. If you extend it to 25 or 30 years, you have lowered the monthly payment because you've stretched it out. There are pluses and minuses to both of those. Then there's a graduated plan. We'll get into the pluses and minuses in a bit. There's a graduated plan where you start off paying so much per month for a couple of years, then it goes up a little the next 2 years, and then the next 3 years. People will understand that the same concept of a balloon mortgage. You start low and then it goes up, or adjustable rate mortgage. The pluses and minuses is another thing that I would like your listeners and applicants and students to think about. It sounds good. Everything has a plus, but you got to look at what might be the downside for you. For example, in that first example, I said you can take $170,000 and toss it into 10 years. Well, I'm looking at my other screen here, and that would be a $2,000 a month payment. Now, when you're starting out and when you're in your residency years, you essentially wouldn't eat. You'd be living for your loans.
What's you did mention the average resident stipend. It's a stipend as a resident. It's not really a salary. The money that you get, what is that breakdown to take home?
All right. I want to do this. Let's do it now because I'm going to put all of this together as we look at these repayment plans. And I'll get back to discussing the repayment plans in a second. But if you take a $50,000 salary, you essentially have to take out your withholdings. People think, oh, I have $50,000. I'm going to make, I'm bringing home so much. No. The government will take out withholdings. Hopefully you balance it out where they take out just what they need. And you don't owe them anything at the end of the year, or they don't take out too much and you get a refund. You may think, oh, that's terrific. Look at this great refund. No, you have given them your money more than you should have.
Interest free.
And they give it back to you at the end of the year. Wouldn't you rather have had that extra money per month? Now, a good tax accountant will sit down with you and say, where are you going to work? What state, what city, how many, and tell you how many dependents to claim when you start work, so it balances out. However, there's a website that I want your listeners to go to try to see how this works. If you type in Google, what tax bracket am I in, dash, it's complicated, it'll take you to the Motley Fool article, very good article that breaks it down. It's not as simple as I'm in the 20% bracket. And you will see that they say 10% of the first $8,900 and then 15% between X and X. So for $50,000, it's coming out to be that you are in the 17% bracket. So you would take $50,000 and you would minus 17%, and you're left with $41,500. So that essentially is what you're taking home for the years. You would divide that by 12, and what you're living on is, say, let's round it down a little, be a little more conservative, $3,400 a month. Students don't, applicants and students and graduates have to say, what exactly do I have to work with? Now I have to decide how I'm going to live. Now you would take out your rent. Now, it varies from place to place. In major urban centers, it could be $1,500 a month. And in many other parts, it could be $900. So I'll use $1,200. So if you take $3,400 and you minus out $1,200 off the bat, you're left with $2,200 every month. Now, what do you have to do with that $2,200? Got to eat. You got to pay your cable bill, your internet bill. You have a cell phone bill. You may need to pay for the upkeep on a car, insurance on a car, and, of course, good old gasoline. And you start deducting those normal expenses, average them out per month, and you'll be left with X amount of dollars. Mm-hmm. Or maybe another way to do it is once you take out your rent, when we look at a typical loan repayment based on $50,000, and this is why I was making a little bit of a joke, for the 10-year plan at $170,000, it's about $2,000 a month. So if you go back and do the math, it doesn't work. Now you could say, well, I'll take the graduated plan. I'll pay it off over 25 years. Well, yeah, it'll drop it down to $1,100, $1,200. But as I said, I should also be telling you about the pros and cons. The pro about a 10-year plan is that it's the cheapest plan. You're leaving your money out there only for 10 years with compounded interest. The 25-year plan is adding a ton more interest, even though it lowered the monthly payment. So that's something you have to think about. The exciting thing, using this example, Ryan, and continuing to discuss the repayment plans and moving into the newer ones, are the repayment plans based on income. The income driven plans. And I'll explain them, and then I'll go back to the example and show you how different it is when you use the income plans.
And these income-based repayment plans, I see them all over the internet. It's abbreviated IBR, correct?
ICR, IBR, and there's a new one, Pay As You Earn, or PAYE, or PAYE.
Okay.
Yes.
For others that are Googling around, this.
Yep,
it can
that's
be
fine.
Confusing.
Yep. If you type in income-driven plans or – yeah. So I'll explain all of those. But essentially, let's talk about in general what are they mean. They basically are looking at your income, your discretionary income, assuming certain – only small percentages of that and deriving your monthly payment. You essentially have to have what they call a partial financial hardship, meaning the amount of loans that you have far exceeds, you know, 10, 15, or 20% of your income. It just would be too much. And because you have that partial hardship, they'll offer you a modest payment. So let me give you some examples. The older plan, which is about 20 years old, is called ICR. Go back to all those alphabet soup names. ICR is called income contingent. For simplicity, of course, I'm going to give them a site they can read up a little bit more about this. For simplicity, the older plan said, we'll look at 20% of your income and discretionary income. Okay. Then in 2007, a new plan came out called IBR, income-based. And it essentially said it's about 15%. You see where I'm going with this. And the new Pay As You Earn, which came out just last December of 12, is 10%. Now, if I stop right here, if I'm talking to students or applicants, I say, what these plans do, it gives you breathing room. You graduate from school. You have a considerable amount of debt. These plans offer you modest loan repayments.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, that's a good thing. So now I can live. I can breathe. I can you know, maybe buy a new car and pay off a car payment.
I can buy a 60-inch TV.
Yeah, I can actually catch up on the news and watch those football games on.
You'll have no time to watch news or.
No, you won't. We all know that. But the point is, you can begin to live. Now, there are pluses and minuses to that as well. But essentially, that's the new thing. Now, there's something else I can talk to you about in a little bit later. Of course, there's loan forgiveness attached to that. But I wanted to go back, Ryan, to the examples we were using.
Okay.
And look at some of the payments.
Before you jump into the examples, these income-based and contingent and pay-as-you-earn, these are all government programs?
Yeah. All the plans I am discussing with you, the old time-driven plans, the 10 extended and graduated, and these three income-based plans or income-driven plans are all U.S. government plans and only apply to the government loans, federal student loans. Now, I know there may be students out there or graduates out there who say, well, I do have some private loans, or I'm thinking of taking out private loans. For those of you who have those private loans, you have to make other plans and deal with your lender at the time and see what options you have for deferment after you graduate and so on and so forth. If you're ever thinking of which loan should I borrow, it's far better to borrow the federal loans because of the safety you have with it, the protections you have, the fact that this is something that most people don't realize. Federal loans do not capitalize the interest while you're in school. It's sitting off on the sidelines. It's not being added back in. It only gets added in later once you get into repayment. So it's cheaper that way. Mm-hmm. Plus, you have all of these options. And again, I go back to having options makes your life a little bit better. And that'll come out a little bit later when we go through the explanations.
Okay.
So what we've said so far, if you're making about $50,000, which is the average residency salary, and you borrowed about $170,000, I used an interest rate of 6.8%. The standard plan would be very high. Remember, you're only taking home about $3,400. You have to subtract your rent and all of the other things out of that. And so the standard plan and the graduated plans, they're a little bit more challenging for you to live off. But when you get to the income plans, here's what happens. On the old income contingent plan, the one that's 20 years old and only wants 20%, you would pay $642 in this scenario. So go back to doing your math, $3,400 minus $1,200, whatever your rent would be. It leaves you X amount of dollars. You can possibly afford this payment depending on what you're doing with the rest of your money and what other entanglements you have. Then when you move to the 15% plan, it comes to $410. Now we're talking a very affordable payment. And then the new pay as you earn if you have – now, this one right now is the way the law is written. If you have no student debt prior to October 1st, 2007, you would qualify. Now, the president in his budget proposal, as we speak, is asking to make that plan available to all borrowers. Okay. But then in that example, it's only $273 a month. So now you're beginning to see if you really want this profession and you unfortunately you do have to borrow some money and maybe a lot of it, you have options. You can come out of school and have modest payments. You can establish your career. You can establish your life. You could get married, perhaps. You could have children. You could save for a house because you have other income left over. If you're using your money properly, you have other money you could do other things with, like save or invest. Now, you can imagine, Ryan, that there's pros and cons to this as well.
Yeah, I'm sitting here picturing, okay, great. It's all pretty up front. And then I'm thinking there has to be a catch. Where am I going to get when are they going to reach into my pockets and take it all?
Well, let me just mention a few other things associated with these plans. The income plan and the IBR plan, the ICR, income-based, and the income contingent, the older plan, the 20%, 50%, those plans have built into it something that happens at the end of 25 years. So let's go back to my examples. You're paying modest payments. You're saying, well, yeah, they're modest payments, but I'm really not chipping off too much of this loan. But if I went along for 25 years, you know, it's like, you know, I have a mortgage, I have my internet every month, and I got this thing called student loan payment. And at the end of 25 years, if I have anything still left over, which you probably would, the government says, you know, that's enough. We'll forgive whatever you have left over at the end of 25 years. And on the pay-as-you-earn plan, because that's the newer plan, it stops at year 20. However, they will look at that savings, that forgiveness piece, whatever the amount is, and they'll look at your tax bracket, and they're going to tax you on that amount. So you could say, yeah, okay, that's nice, but you know, I may have to pay this tax at the end of 20 or 25 years, but I have better options.
But and let me let me point out that most of the students, you're not paying $410 a month for 20 years because it is based on your income. Your income is going to go up, well, hopefully, during those 20 years. So
yeah.
So you are going to be paying more, but you can still pay it, and maybe we can get into it later. Maybe some exclusionary things for the income-based stuff, but you don't have to pay the minimum $410 for the, you're not you
no.
won't be paying the $410 for the whole 20 years. That would
no,
be nice.
That would be nice, but you're right. It is based on income, but again, it's only that small percentage. Remember, if your income goes to, you know, $200,000, you're taking in $10,000 a month after the deduction, so on. But you can always pay more. You could say, you know, I have to, you know, I'll pay $800 a month. I'll make believe I'm doubling it up, and there's never a penalty, and so on and so forth. But there are other options, though. Now, the federal government has created something called the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Plan, if you would. And here's what this is. If you're in the 10-year plan, the standard plan, if you're in the income-driven plans that we just described, income contingent, income-based, pay-as-you-earn, if you're in any one of those four plans and you're making payments, and you just so happen to be working in a not-for-profit setting, public hospital, city hospital, veterans, any government facility, county, state, federal. You know what? You could be the staff physician of the American Red Cross, and they're a not-for-profit. You could go back into academic medicine, work at a medical school, teach and see patients. And, of course, you're associated with the U.S. Air Force, Army, Navy.
Air Force, yep.
And so you're not for profit. When you are making payments in those four plans and you're being paid that month by a not for profit, that's a marriage of one. You do that for 120 times or 10 years. At the end of that 10-year period, you have complete loan forgiveness of whatever's left over, and this time they will not tax you. So you can imagine, you'll have more sitting out there in 10 years than you would have in 25, and you'll have the loan forgiveness. Now, but you're working in a not-for-profit for 10 years. So he says, okay, that sounds good too. Well, let's think about this for a minute. Well, if we said at the beginning of the recording, the podcast, you shouldn't just pick a med school based on money. You should go deeper and go deeper and go deeper. Well, it kind of works the same way with this. You say, okay, I'll borrow as much as I want, more than I need, because I'm going to have loan forgiveness. Well, I don't know about that. You know, it's 14 years away from your first year in med school that you might get loan forgiveness. So what are we talking about? Well, it's a question of, should you pick now your hospital or your career once you leave med school, once you're interviewing, based on the fact that they're not for profit or not, or should be the kind of setting and the kind of work situation that's best for you. Another thing, you know, you may be in your 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 year residency or fellowship, and yeah, most likely that's not for profit. Those years will count towards the 10. But what do you do after that? Do you stay in the not for profit world, or do you move to a private practice? Here's why. You probably will. I mean, it's a safe statement to say you'll be paid less in the not-for-profit world than you would in the for-profit world. What if it's a difference of $30,000, $40,000, or $50,000 a year, and you have 4 or 5 years past your residency and fellowship to go towards the 10 years? Well, what matters more, having $200,000 or $250,000 that you could earn in the private sector versus working in the not-for-profit sector and getting some loan forgiveness? Is there a family involved? Are there other people involved in that decision? So I have to explain all of that as well. We have to explain things on the coming into a med school, then we have to explain the pros and cons as well. Now, someone is going to have a very long residency and fellowship, Ryan, 7 or 8 years, maybe 9 years. Now, they're almost there. But I think for those, the average residency is probably 4 to 5 years with fellowship. I think you have to think about that. However, if you choose to stay in the not-for-profit, you have this this terrific option available to you. Now, the one thing we have to always think about, and students always ask this, what could happen to this plan?
Let me interrupt you real quick, because I got something buzzing through my head.
Go ahead.
Not all hospitals are nonprofit.
No.
Are all residencies? What if you do a residency at a for-profit hospital?
Well, here's what I'm discovering. Not all hospitals, true, are not-for-profit. But this is an odd thing. I always tell the students thinking about emergency medicine, you have a little bit of a quirky situation. You could be working at a not-for-profit hospital, and you could be paid by a for-profit outsourced payments company, and it won't count because you're not being paid by the not-for-profit, so to speak.
So a little research has to go into it.
Well, here's what I'm telling students now, and I'm going to tell – well, you tell the applicants, but when it comes time to third year, I start really telling the third-year students, when you are preparing to go on your interviews and when you're on your interview, ask two questions. Are you a not-for-profit? And there's a specific title from the IRS called 501c3. But you could be a not-for-profit without that designation as well. And who – will pay me? Are you not for profit and who will pay me? I've heard estimates of 80 to 90% of the hospitals are not for profit, or 10 to 20% aren't. But even within that, you've got to ask the question, who pays me? Okay. Good question. So those are some of the things that you have to think about, but you don't have to feel paralyzed as an applicant. That you really, this is never going to work out. You will never have a life. You will be paying these loans back and getting Social Security at the same time. It doesn't have to go that route at all. And I think the income plans are the best. Now, I was starting to say, students ask, well, this sounds good. You know, you can get loan forgiveness. Could this plan disappear? Now, in all of my experience, and I've been doing this a very long time, What the federal government tends to do when it makes changes is they phase changes it. They will say from this date on, anyone X who's new at this, you get these terms. The rest of you keep what you have. And we recently saw this. If you remember, we used to have on the graduate level the subsidized Stafford loan and the unsubsidized Stafford loan. Okay? Well, starting last year, the government phased out on for the graduate level the subsidized Stafford loan, but from that moment on, from last year on. Now, what could happen to this plan, and this is something I always want students and applicants to take a piece of that wonderful brain and keep it open about politics and policy. Here's what happens. If I said to you, Ryan, I want you to go out there and speak badly about this and create a headline, you would come up with something like, how do you like this, America? All these rich doctors are getting hundreds of thousands of dollars of loan forgiveness per student. And when you add up the loan forgiveness, half their medical school we paid for. That's the kind of thing we have to think about. Because there's a lot of people who might not like the fact that people get loan forgiveness, although they are earning it, but they don't like it.
That was Obama's statement when he said you didn't do it alone.
Yeah, I know. So you may see things like, okay, if you make $200,000 or more, you'll only get 80% loan forgiveness. Or if you have that kind of income or higher, you have to take 15 years for your loan forgiveness. I'm just giving you possible mm-hmm. ways that Washington works. So we keep our eyes on that. You can always make another statement. They're working 80 hours a week. They're doing marvelous work with their lives and so on and so forth. So I think interjecting the political and the policy and the legislative ain't a bad thing. It's something to also keep in the back of your head.
Okay.
Can I state now some of the websites I'd like them to follow up with? We will have some other questions, but there's a very good site. Now, let me explain this to our listeners. The federal government owns the student loan program. The Department of Education is your lender. The government is your lender. But since it's such a big program, you know, they can't monitor it themselves. So what they do, and they often do, there's so many different kinds of government contracts out there, they outsource it to loan servicers. So there's four major services. They parcel up all the tens of millions of students who are out there, and they're going to service your loan. They're going to be in touch with you. It's like a branch of the military. You're the Air Force, and somebody will get the Army. So what that means is that they're going to talk to you, work with you. You can deal with them and so on and so forth. That's something that they also need to know as well, that there'll be services along the way.
Yeah, and for example, I think Bank of America for a while owned my loans, and then they sold it to another company that now contacts me. So it can juggle between multiple companies.
Yeah, and there was even some confusion a couple of years ago when you, a student, could have three servicers because they were changing everything over from the old system to the new system. Now, one of the servicers, you've heard of them. You've heard of Sallie Mae. They happen to be a servicer now. You've heard of Great Lakes, maybe Nelnet, but there's one called FedLoans, and this is a site I want your listeners to go to. It is a site where they have this repayment schedule estimator. So if you typed in Google my FedLoans dash repayment schedule estimator, you get this very clean, neat one screen program, and what it allows you to do is put in your income or any income. And what I like to tell the medical students about to leave, play with incomes. Mm-hmm. See what happens as your income rises. And you said that, Ryan, you're not always going to be at $50,000. You could be at $250,000. Mm-hmm. So you can put an income in. You put your total federal loan balance. You put an interest rate, 6.8, whatever you want. You hit the tab, and the next thing you know on the right, all of the different plans I spoke about show what your payment would be based on your loans awesome. And or your income. Awesome.
And this is if let me throw a wrench in there. If yeah. I married another physician who also Good. Makes $200,000, am I using my income or combined okay. income?
Very good. Let's get into some of the intricacies. I think everybody pretty much understands this. Let's go into some of the granular kinds of things. One, the government and these plans allow you to file separately as a married couple. And if you file separately, then it's still just your income and your loans. So instead of each of you making $150,000, that would be $300,000. So if you put $300,000 in this calculator, you may not qualify for those income plans because you don't have the partial hardship anymore. However, it does allow you to file separately and say, I only make $150,000. Now, pros and cons, Ryan. What do you lose if you file separately? You lose marriage tax breaks and all kinds of other things. So
ask
again,
your tax advisor.
Yes, I always say I'm not a tax accountant. You must make that decision and then weigh the pros and cons to it. But it does allow you to do that. Now, also, it takes into consideration the fact that if there's two or three in the family with dependents, there are changes. So if you take the same scenario, if your listeners can get to the screen, and then you add two dependents, and you keep looking at the income plans, you notice that they're now lower. If you add a baby, they go even lower. So it adjusts, as it should, for expenses other than student loans.
Okay.
And of course, if he has two kids, it goes lower and lower and so forth. So you might say, well, we can keep our combined income. We can file jointly because we have two kids. It may make a difference. Again, okay. More granular.
I'll have a link to that again in the show notes. So those driving down the road don't need to write down this information right now.
Absolutely. And again, you'll have all the links. Now, some other granular things about the public service loan forgiveness piece. One, it doesn't have to be consecutive. So you graduate with debt. You learn about these wonderful income plans. You go into it and you're doing your residency and fellowship. It's 5 years, let's say. It's been in a not-for-profit. You have 5 years of not-for-profit and making payments in the bank. That counts. It's linked. And it actually will show up on the servicer website. You had 120 payments to go. You've just made 60. You know, you have 60 to go. Okay. So you say, well, you know, I have this opportunity to take this job at a private practice. I'm going for it. Well, obviously, for the next year or two, that's not going to count. You can still make your payments and the plans and so forth, but it doesn't count. After 2 years, you say, you know what? I've got this burning desire to do academic medicine. I want to teach. I don't want to see patients. I'm going back to New York Medical College and I'm going to teach there or whatever. Guess what? The clock picks up again. Now you're at a not-for-profit. And if you do another 5 years, it'll be 12 altogether from the time you started. But you got five, you stop for two, you go back and do the rest, it all counts. Now, another little granular piece, you don't have to do 80 hours a week or 60 hours a week. If, as long as you're doing 30 hours a week in that not-for-profit, it counts. So that may mean, oh, I can, instead of doing 45 hours a week, I can stop out, I have a kid, and get home a little bit earlier maybe and reduce my workload. As long as I'm putting 30 hours in, I'm still counting for one payment that month and a paycheck that month, I'm linked. So, again, more options with pros and cons along the way.
All right. Good to know.
So, one of the other sites you'll have for them is, besides the repayment schedule, besides what tax bracket I'm in, I really would like them to start with a Google search, simple federal student aid. It'll be federal student aid home. You know you're on the right page when you see five or six profiles of average Americans, right? Well, they have different categories. The one I would like your listeners to go to, actually jump to, is the Repay Your Loans tab at the top, or you see it at the bottom. Now, this is from the source. I want to go right to the source. You could do all kinds of other Google searches, but you don't know where you're going. Some of it wants you to pay for things. This is the government source from the Department of Ed. And you'll have the different kinds of repayment plans. You'll have the loan forgiveness plans. You'll understand cancellation, if something went wrong, if you're unemployed, which should not happen. What is a loan servicer? It's all there with detail. So you might want to start there, then you can get into the more esoteric kinds of things about tax brackets and actually what will my loan payments be.
Okay.
So those are the three things I'd like them to use.
All right. That's great. So let me throw one more wrench at you.
I love wrenches. Go ahead.
Something that unfortunately is a huge deal. As of last year, it was in the news with about 500 or so U.S. medical school graduates not getting a residency spot.
It's actually 1,100 this year.
It was 1,100 this year. Okay.
Yeah.
What happens to a student that doesn't get a residency spot when they have loans to pay back?
Yeah. You have protections there and you have options there as well. There are in-school deferments where they don't expect you to pay, obviously, because you're a full-time student. There's deferments when you leave for a little bit. There's something called forbearance, saying, look, I'm having a little trouble right now. Can you put me into forbearance? If you looked up the word, it's patience, but forbearance is legal. It doesn't hurt your credit score, and it just buys you time for 6 months or a year. However, they also would have an unemployment deferment. However, here's what I would do. I would tell that student to go into one of these income plans. You would have no income.
Huh?
They would give you a zero payment.
Yeah.
And the months would still count.
Even if you're paying 50 cents, it still counts.
Still counts.
I like it.
That's one-on-one with that particular person.
Yeah.
So you still have options. No one's going to say, oh, that's too bad. No. They don't want you to default.
Yeah.
And they do have lots of safety nets.
Okay. Good to know.
And that's why I say stay with federal student loans, because these are the kinds of things you get with it. The private loans don't have these kinds of – they don't have loan forgiveness plans. And unfortunately, with some private loans, the year you take it out, they only count 4 or 5 years from that year. So I'm seeing students who are first and second year medical students who took these loans out 5 years ago, 4 years ago. The money's coming due.
Yeah.
Not good.
And that brings us full circle back to your original statement. The more options you have, the better. And private loans just limit your options.
They absolutely do.
Okay.
Remember, this is not only about you, applicant, listener. There will be and there may be other people in your life. So we're planning and protecting them as well.
Yeah.
And again, all of these options help them too.
Yeah. And just one one caveat and something that I struggled with in medical school, and I'm not ashamed to talk about it, is credit card debt. Credit card debt is a huge limiter of your options.
You got it. Ryan, I was thinking about it as I was speaking before, and I was trying to say to myself, remember to mention it. Thank you for bringing it up. All of these wonderful things we talked about. Hey, I'm only going to make a small payment. I can save money. I can have the car. I can have a kid. I can maybe save for a house because I have these modest payments. You know, the one thing that tips the boat and throws it completely out of whack are the credit card payments. Go back to that example, $3,400 minus $1,200 rent, and then you have a $600 or $700 credit card payment. Well, there it goes.
Yep.
What's left? Very little. Now you're actually going to struggle because, you know, if something emergency comes up, you're sunk. So the more we can stress, use your cards as convenience. Use them for emergencies, but they're not a lifestyle.
Yeah.
The more you do that now, the better it is. We've been pretty lucky. Our graduates come out with under the national average for medical students with credit card debt. And I try to do my best to get that message to them even before they come. So it's, you know, everybody has to do their share a little bit about that. But thanks for bringing that up. That is critical. All of this doesn't work if you do that, but so far so good.
All right, folks. That was Tony Sozo with a ton of great information. I hope you made it all the way through because there was information out the wazoo all the way through there. I do want to mention one more time the Academy. Go to medicalschoolhq.net/academy before September 26th at 3 p.m. Eastern to get in the special charter member rate. Less than two, the cost is less than two cups of coffee a month. Very doable. Awesome community. I'm having a blast reading everybody's information as they're trickling in and posting about themselves. It's awesome to see real names and faces and actually be able to interact like normal human beings. And I really hope you consider joining us. So with that said, I hope what we provided for you today was great, and I hope that you join us next time here at the Medical School Headquarters.